Welcome to the RSP cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, and I got Mark Schofield over here fired up for our next version of the Quick Game. Mark, welcome aboard once again.
Matt, it's great to be back with you. And you alluded to right there that you got me fired up. And the way you did that was just moments ago before I joined you, I retweeted an article about Toto. And you responded with, they had a picture of Steve Lukather, one of their centers, and you responded with a quip, is Robert Downey Jr. in character for another funny movie? And I know you did that for the sole reason to get me angry before we recorded, because, you know, sometimes it's good to write angry, it's good to podcast angry, because you're going to have more emotion behind the words and what you're saying. So this is just evidence of Matt Waldman doing what he needs to do to get those around him to be successful. It's brilliant. It's what offensive coordinators need to do with young quarterbacks. It's well executed. So I tip my hat to you, sir. But yes, I'm now fired up and ready to go.
All right. Well, let's start with the first question here. So the first 8 to 10 games, in my opinion, of rookie quarterback play is like entering the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. See, everything seems fine early on. Looks like a nice place. But strange things start happening, and soon enough, you're experiencing a true horror film, and your coaches are coming after you with an axe. So does Daniel Jones have the shine kind of like Danny Torrance, or is he more likely to be like Danny's dad winding up in a bathtub kissing a rotting corpse?
I want to say, and this is sort of tough to admit, but I do think he's got the shine. And what's interesting about Jones is that, and I know we're going to get into this a little bit later given the run sheet for this show, but he had some tools in his toolkit when he came out, the athletic ability, the quick processing in the short area of the field. I loved him as sort of a West Coast quarterback, but his ability to handle pressure has been better than expected. You watch his first game against Tampa Bay, and look, the numbers, when you first saw them, they were unheard of. He was the first quarterback in PFF's entire history to have more than 12 passing attempts in a game. That's 1,674 passers, but he was the only one to have a perfect passer rating in their history. He's the list. That's unheard of. But when you look at the film, it's not like he's creating this pressure. He's just reacting to what's around him. So I've been very impressed with him so far. That could go away, but to date, I think there's something to this kid that is very impressive.
Wow, with 1 second left. Very well done. Very well done. All right. So stop it. There we go. All right. So I'm going to say that this jury's still out for me. I'm going to take a more pessimistic view. But I agree with you that the notable thing that we're probably going to talk about a little bit later on is how he handled pressure. Because watching him last week, he still looked like a stiff in the pocket to me the first week. I thought there were moments where maybe he held on the ball a little bit too long when he had to make full field reads and seemed a little confused, or he didn't feel backside pressure very well. I didn't think he felt backside pressure very well with Shaq Barrett, you know, looming there. But last weekend, watching him with the backside pressure, he seemed to grow eyes in the back of his head that he never had. And I was kind of surprised by that. So, I still think the full field reads thing is a bit of an issue. I still think that there's a little bit lacking in the sum of the tape that I've seen of him points to me that he's a little bit more, that I'm still not convinced of the play that, you know, he's getting a lot of first and second reads that are kind of pre-designed for him that I think defenses are going to take away a little bit more down the line here. Cautiously optimistic, but I still think the haunted house is probably going to get the best of him.
Ooh, you think the haunted house is coming? Ooh, that's an interesting sound. So you think the haunted house is coming?
I see how we're going to go. Yeah.
It's October. We know what this month can do to people.
That's right. So let's move on from one guy who's entered a house and it seems nice and we don't know whether it's haunted or not, to a team that seems to have been like started their season smack dab in the middle of Amityville. And that's the Cleveland Browns. Did they figure out their offense Sunday against the Ravens? Or are they going to drastically change the game plan again and they're going to go right back inside?
I think from a conceptual standpoint, from a scheme standpoint, I think they did some things against the Ravens that I really liked. I love the way they would come back to shallow cross a lot. They would come back to mesh a lot, given Baker things that he's familiar with. But I think the bigger thing for this offense going forward is what we saw from Baker himself. If you watch the first couple of weeks, he insisted on bailing from pockets. He insisted on vacating out the back door, even from clean pockets. You watch him against Baltimore. He was determined to stay in the pocket. Normally, we would see him vacate. He would hand in the pocket. He would fight in the pocket. He would make throws from the pocket. Because when you vacate the pocket, sometimes you can make those splash, scramble, drill type plays that Baker does so well at. But other times, you just condense the field in half and you make it easier for defense to defend you. So him fighting the pocket, I think, is the bigger element to how this offense can be successful going forward. And we saw that from him on Sunday.
Nice. Yeah. I think I'm going to say that they have figured it out. And I think what they figured out is that Nick Chubb is the centerpiece of this offense. And I think that the way that they did that is instead of running him from shotgun where he doesn't have a two-way go to go downhill and where, you know, they have him running east-west in one direction. And if penetration comes, he has really no other outlet to go other than to break a tackle or go further outside, which can be really hampering to a running back with Chubb's skills. Because Chubb's the type of guy, if you get him heading downhill and there's penetration, he has multiple ways that he can choose to go, and he's very skilled at being able to do that. So I think that the Browns did a better job of using Mayfield from under center and varying formation types to using 10 personnel, 12 personnel, 20 personnel, and being able to get boxes that not only made Chubb's day even better, but also they could do a lot more variation with with motioning wide receivers and misdirection and pitch plays and downhill plays. And it also helped the play action game because it was much more believable to sell when you have Chubb lined up in that type of an alignment as a single back than it is having him in the shotgun where blockers aren't, you know, even an advantageous position to have good leverage because they're already in kind of a pass set as opposed to being in a more run set with their finger in their hand in the dirt. So I think they figured it out, and I think they're about to roll moving forward.
Yeah, I think you're right about all of that. I think that's a great way to sort of frame it. I think the play action stuff is going to be huge for them, and you set that up pretty well.
Okay, cool. Okay, so, all right. I'm just asking this for a friend, Mark.
hypothetically.
Just a hypothetical. I'm asking on behalf of an old college friend, someone that I just felt like really good, friendly, you know, very friendly with at the University of Georgia, and he's now in Detroit. Can you play with a ruptured disc in your back?
You can put up 1,122 yards, 9 touchdowns, and 2 interceptions for a quarterback rating of 102.6 with a ruptured disc in your back. I mean, I think that's kind of the way to answer it. Look, Stafford has been fascinating to watch over the past couple of seasons. He's a quarterback that I've talked about with you before that, you know, he's a guy I'd like to see in New England if that could possibly happen. I really am a fan of his game. I'm a fan of the ability that he can show on a week-to-week basis with arm angles, with velocity, with placement, and all sorts of stuff. But he's also shown some toughness this season. I mean, look, he struggled through injuries last year, struggling through injuries again this year. To take basically Kansas City, that team, to the brink, like they did last week, even though, look, it was a home game for Detroit, and we know that Chiefs defense can struggle at times. He threw 3 touchdowns against them, but he's been extremely effective this year, playing through pain. It's one of those things that you see a quarterback do it. You want to believe in them as a teammate, as a player. You want to believe in them as a fan of that team. So, yeah, he's done it.
Nice, nice, yeah. And I'm going to agree with you. I'm going to say I think he can, and I think the reason he can is I think this offensive line is better. I think this team is better. I think that this team is not your older brother's Lions, as I talked about in the top 10 at Football Guys this week. This defense is playing tougher. They have a good defensive line. They're back 7, know how to make plays on the ball. They seem to all have gotten the Peanut Tillman, you know, certificate of excellence for punching the ball loose. They did that 4 times against the Chiefs last weekend, and it was just beautiful to watch what they were doing in terms of just if you're just appreciate good technique and a certain type of skill that they were applying expertly. And then addition to the fact that this is a really strong offense, I think it's a very athletic offensive line that's growing into its own, and they're starting to realize that, hey, Kerryon Johnson can carry the load. That Auburn tape, yeah, that might translate to the NFL. He might be a load carry that we can use week to week, and use him as a versatile option. And I think that keeps Stafford in situations that as long as his receivers are healthy, he's going to play well and he can tough it out. And yeah, he's going to be stiff in the morning. He's going to have to work out some kinks. He's going to deal with pain. But yeah, I like
nice.
It.
Nice. Very nice.
All right. So, all right. Can you get rid of the hero complex that Josh Allen has, or is he going to get baited into doing too much by savvy defenses like he did against New England this past weekend?
I want to believe that you can get rid of it because, look, he's now had a full 16-game slate. He's had his full year, and now we're into year two in a sense, and he'll hopefully learn and develop. I want to say he can get rid of it, but that window is closing for him to be able to do that because dating back to his days at Wyoming, so many times his plan B, no matter what concept they were running, was I'm going to flush myself to the right and throw it as hard as I can downfield. And he's still doing stuff like that. It took on a bit of a different form Sunday against the Patriots because it was more, I'm going to drop back into the pocket as far as I can, almost to my own end zone, and then throw it as far as I can downfield. He did that on one play where I was like, is this a 25-step drop? Because that's what it looked like live. It looked like – and it was weird because Dan Fouts was doing the game. And I'm like, this is like Foutsian in a sense. And he overthrows a vertical route. Mm-hmm. And then on the very next play, he does the same thing, backpedaling away from pressure, forces a throw, and it's picked off. And I want to think he can unlearn this stuff because he's made such great strides so far this year. But that window for unlearning that muscle memory is closing fast. So it's the timer.
Yeah. There, yeah. It's ooh, all right now. But, yeah, I mean, I like your points there, and I'm surprised that Dan said, I don't see anything wrong here.
Right. Dan had a rough game, too. Let's be honest. You know, a lot of people had rough games Sunday up and below. Dan was on that list.
All right. Well, I'll start
the clock now, too. Say, so, yeah.
All right. I appreciate it. All right. So I'll say this. Allen, yes, I don't think it's going to change. I think that it's one of those issues that people will look at Matthew Stafford or and say, well, Stafford made some dumb throws throughout his career. And I'd say the difference is it's a subtle difference, but an important one is that I think Stafford had a lot of receivers not named Calvin Johnson who dropped the ball, and he'd put the ball in great situations and they drop it. And then he found himself in situations where it was like he'd get frustrated and go, well, I only have one or two options that I can deliver a ball to and think they're going to actually catch it. So I'm going to have to make tougher throws. I'm going to have to do some more difficult things. Or he had receivers who just couldn't get open. And I think that that's the difference is where Stafford made mistakes. And he'd occasionally have a dumb one. But I think every quarterback occasionally has some dumb decisions where they try to do too much because they were stars at their lower levels. But I think Allen does it too much. And I fear that mentality is never going to change.
Excellent. Yeah, I think you kind of nailed that. 10 seconds to spare. But yeah, I do sort of sense like it's not going anywhere. This is just who he is.
Yeah. So let's move a little bit to the college game because, you know, you and I watch a little college football from time to time.
Time to time.
Who's the college quarterback that you've been impressed with?
I think it's Joe Burrow. And there have been guys, you know, Tua is Tua, and I think he's a very impressive quarterback. I've been very impressed with Fields up at Ohio State. I think Ryan Day is using him extremely well. Jalen Hurts, you know, could we see another Oklahoma quarterback win the Heisman? If Oklahoma makes a title run, I think he'd be in the mix with that. But from an evaluation standpoint, I've been very impressed with Burrow because he's doing more within the confines of this LSU offense. It's not known to have a vertical passing game. It's not known to be a quarterback-friendly offense, but he's executing it extremely well. He's manipulating defenders with his eyes. He had a touchdown throw against Texas in the red zone where he really moved that backside safety. Got him to bite on one route, on a curl route to a wide, so comes back and throws a band-aid post route for a touchdown. I've been extremely impressed with Burrow. He's going to have a couple big games coming up. He even gets Jordan Love and Utah State up this week, I think. So he'll have some tests. But if he keeps passing it like he has been, he's played himself into that mix. Maybe day two, maybe late day one. I don't know. Stock is rising.
Yeah. And I'm going to say that my official answer is Joe Burrow as well, because okay. I noticed the same thing with Texas. And I love the fact that he's confident. Like when you watch a lot of times because of the way that we present material, I think people get sucked into the idea that we watch play to play about a player as opposed to seeing groups of plays together or series together or things like that, where you can see a guy overcome mistakes or where a bad situation happens and then you see him show the same confidence to go and attack the defense in a very similar way that other players might be reticent to do after that mistake. And Burrow moves around the pocket well, throws off platform well, and still does it in rhythm. And he'll go back and attack something, even if he had a bad result earlier in the game or even a play before. So I like that about him. And I'll give a quick mention to Anthony Gordon out of Washington State. I love how quick his release is and how he is off platform. And I think that there's some manipulation skills there that I really like. So he's another one I'll give an honorable mention to.
Fantastic. You got 15 seconds. Anybody else?
Oh, boy, I would have to check. But, you know, I do love Tua. I mean, I think that there's a lot to like about him, but I do, you know, there's some interesting things with his game. And if you're listening to me, I'll just give this little public service announcement. When I do RSP film rooms and boiler rooms, they're not definitive scouting reports. They're just me showing what I do along the way.
There you go, people.
So, right. So what's something, Mark, what's something strategic or conceptual or emotional that you think is teachable to young quarterbacks when they enter the NFL?
We'll go sort of with, and it might sound like I'm going back on what I was just saying about Josh Allen here, but I do think, and we've talked about this before, it's, let's just say it's easier to get the aggressive quarterback to dial things back than it is to get the conservative quarterback to suddenly become aggressive. And so I think for quarterbacks that have that sort of aggressive, sort of quote unquote gunslinger mentality that we often heard with, obviously, Patrick Mahomes, it's easier to get them to sort of dial things back just a little bit. It's much harder to get a guy like Alex Smith and suddenly get him to play aggressive, to get him to take more chances with the football. Because if you're naturally a risk-averse type of person, you're not going to unlearn that. That's just no way. I know this. I am a risk-averse person. It's just not going to happen. And so I think almost by default, when you look at it through that prism, it's easier to get these aggressive guys to sort of dial it back. Allen might be an exception to that, but we'll see.
Okay. So I'm going to say that it's probably easier to get a quarterback to throw the ball away. I think that it takes a couple of years for that light to actually come on. But after you get after you're force fed some turf for a number of games and you're banged up and you're hurt and your teammates are mad at you because you did some dumb play that where you could have thrown the ball away and you tried to be the hero, and instead of trying to throw the ball away, I think that that's something that a lot of young guys immediately, if they just learn to throw the ball away and check down. And those are two things that I think you see guys as they get their head clearer about what it means to be an NFL quarterback and how to manage a game well, that the best quarterbacks do that. You even hear the young ones say that a lot, even though you believe that they don't, that you think they only believe it about half the time still. But as they get to about 27, 28, 29, they start to realize, especially as when they wake up the next morning, that it really does help them out. And they start to see the wins compile it too.
23 seconds left. Any last thoughts?
Oh, that's okay.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think we're good.
You're going to reserve your time for later if you need it.
I might, yeah. That and I'm just throwing the ball away.
You just throw it away. Check it out. You know, live to fight on third down.
That's right. So we got more time left. So let's talk about the opposite of that. What's something that's strategic, conceptual, or emotional, Mark, that you think can't be taught? And you can, I have a feeling I know where you're going because you mentioned it just a minute ago here a little bit, but what you don't think is easy for a quarterback.
Right. I mean, I'll just mention briefly the idea of the more conservative, risk-averse quarterbacks suddenly becoming this aggressive passer that's going to challenge windows, throw it downfield, and take some risks with the ball. I think that's very hard, if not impossible, to learn. But I'm going to go in a different direction for the official answer here and just say mechanics. Like, how many times have we spent, you know, a draft process or a draft cycle or an evaluation period, looking at a quarterback and say, well, you know, he needs to clean these things up. He needs to clean up the motion. He needs to fix his footwork. You get to this point, even if you're just a one-year starter in college like a Mitchell Trubisky, this is who you are. This is what your mechanics are going to be. You've been playing this game long enough. It's not going to change. And so then that gets us into the realm of how bad are the mechanics and do they impact the actual performance on the field? We've seen it with Mitchell Trubisky where, yes, that left foot, the bucket step, it does. With Patrick Mahomes, no, it doesn't. The mechanics don't matter. He puts the ball wherever he wants to. He could probably hit me in the face right now from Kansas City all the way to DC. So mechanics are the things that you can't really change.
There you go. And I agree with the mechanics part because it's a lot like instrumentalists. And when I think about music, I mean, you know, I think of a story about where my daughter went to, you know, she played the viola for a little while and she really enjoyed playing. She played all the way through high school and occasionally plays, I guess, when she's, you know, when she's home from leave from the Marines right now. But one of the things is that I remember early in her career, after a couple of years, she met with someone who played in a local symphony or a city symphony and looked at her and said, yeah, well, she's a skilled musician in terms of a young musician, but her technique's already ruined. And you kind of go, well, what does that mean? And it's like, well, she's learned the wrong way. So it's already ingrained so that the ability to really maximize those skills on the highest level aren't going to be there. It's going to be very difficult to do. And that's a harsh thing for young people to hear or parents of young people to hear if they have these like crazy dreams of wanting their kid to do something that maybe even their kid doesn't want to do. But we didn't feel that way. I mean, it was just kind of one of those things where you understand that, you know, that this was a high-end professional talking about, you know, how people learn and what it means in that small margin of difference. And that small margin of error is there when it comes to quarterback play with technique.
Yeah. I think that's well said, really well analogized there, Mr. Waldman.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Schofield. So what do you think about backup quarterbacks in the NFL? Is there a quarterback in the NFL that you would like to see earn a real shot to start who hasn't gotten that shot?
I'm going to go with Nick Mullins. And what's interesting about Mullins is he was somebody that wasn't on a lot of radar, certainly really wasn't on mine when he was coming out of college. But when I got a chance this past offseason to sort of study what he did in replace of Garoppolo and C.J. Beathard and to think about him from a sort of conceptual and scheme fit standpoint, I actually ended up writing a piece for Pat's Pulpit making the case that he should be the next Patriots quarterback. He should be the guy that they look to replace Tom Brady, because when you see him functioning within that Kyle Shanahan system, when you see him doing the little things like moving defenders with his eyes and understanding leverage and making well-placed throws to lead receivers to safety, when you see him working through reads, when you see him stressing defenses to all levels with velocity and with accuracy that, again, people didn't really think he had coming out. I came away very impressed, and I thought he would be a fantastic fit in most offenses. I thought he would be a fantastic fit in what New England likes to do. And so I'm going to go with Nick Mullins. I think he's a guy that, if given the chance, could win a starting job in this league.
Very good. Very good. I like that. So I'm so damn predictable. You know who I'm say. Yeah. You know, and I think everyone knows who I'm going to say, but it's really a good jumping off point to continue the answer from the last question we had about what do you think is difficult to teach? And I think that's what Chad Kelly has, which is confidence to fire that ball in when he sees the information that needs to be clear to most quarterbacks, but they usually wait 1 to 2 beats for confirmation. And it's, again, it's that performance thing where it's like reading leverage. It's something that I was looking at Tua Tagovailoa against Georgia in the SEC championship last year. And there were a couple of plays where he didn't really respond to the leverage as quickly as he probably should have compared to a top end NFL quarterback. Now, you know, different realms, and he has time to demonstrate that may have just been 1 or 2 plays, you know. But I thought it was a good jumping off point to discuss, because it is something hard to teach overall, that when you see that information, even though it's not quote unquote open now, you have to get rid of the ball. And Kelly's really, really good at that, at attacking and just knowing the information. And it's a sense of internal timing and confidence that you can get it done when the visual tells you that it's not open, even though it's kind of a counterintuitive thing, but you have to be intuitive about the counterintuitive. And I think Chad Kelly's good in that respect. Let's hope that maybe, you know, he can prove that he's worth a shot somewhere.
That's a fantastic answer. And you, as one of my first law school professors told me, you came loaded for bear on that one.
There we go. Well, Mark, let's talk about Teddy. Could Teddy wind up back in Minnesota? I don't know. I think about Kirk Cousins and, you know, how he's performed thus far. And if for some reason he could wind up back in Minnesota, would you prefer him to Cousins if that was a possibility?
We are recording this on October 2nd. It is a Wednesday in the year of our Lord, 2019. And sitting here right now, absolutely, having spent a good portion of my week and last week studying Kirk Cousins and this Minnesota offense, Kirk Cousins is not getting there. He's not getting the job done. And it, in a sense, it comes down to the Baker versus Chef question, which we spent a lot of time in the summer talking about. He just, if everything is there and he has the right answers and he goes step by step and the step is perfect, then yes, he could be successful. But if he has to deviate even the slightest bit, I mean, I just got done working up something where he's got a dig route on a Mills concept. He sees the back of the linebacker running away from him, cut your drop short, and get the ball out. Instead, he goes through the final two steps of his drop, takes the hitch that he was taught to take, and then throws it. By then, the window is closed, and the pass gets knocked down and should have gotten picked. I think more than anything else, this is an indictment of Cousins rather than a vote of confidence in Bridgewater. But yeah, I would take Teddy over Cousins right now in a heartbeat if I'm Minnesota.
I agree, obviously. And I think the reason that is, you know, obviously that it would hurt this team from the standpoint of the deep game, because Teddy just does not throw a good deep ball, and that's an issue. But in the intermediate game, his ability to also avoid pressure, reset, and fire, and to be patient about creating windows to come open, he has two really good receivers who are skilled in the slot, especially Thielen, who can work open. And I would think that Teddy and Thielen would be a really good match for how they could work together when he has to go off script. And I think that would be a positive. And this team just needs a guy who can manage a game pretty well and not try and not have some of the, you know, the harsh mistakes that Kirk Cousins can make. He's streaky. He can be way better than what Bridgewater might be week to week in any given week, but he can also be a lot worse. So I would find it a bit of irony and fun to see Teddy Bridgewater take over from there. And I loved how you let off with that date, because it could be prophetic.
It could be, my friend. But yeah, I mean, it's just not there for him. Cousins right now, it's just not there.
Yeah, it isn't at all. So going from one who doesn't seem to be having it to one who seems to have it in spades, does Gardner Minshew keep his job in Jacksonville when Nick Foles returns?
He better. And look, I liked him coming out. I liked him. Like, he was, you know, it wasn't my top 7, 8 or quarterbacks. I think it was like QB9 for me. But he was just, you could tell that he had that it factor. When you talk to him down in Mobile, when you see him interviewed, when he wears the jorts, I mean, he just has something about him. But the other thing is that I've been extremely impressed with the touch in the vertical passing game. Now, when you see him coming out of Washington State, you see that air raid. It's a lot of, you know, quick throws and stuff to the boundary, but there were some deep shots here and there that were good. The vertical stuff this season, especially to a receiver we're going to talk about in a moment, has been unexpected and an extremely pleasant surprise. And so the way that this team is playing, the way that the city is starting to believe in this kid, the way that he's sort of captivated that locker room, that comeback win last week against Denver, I think it's hard. Unless he starts stumbling, I think it's hard to bench him.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is hard to bench him. And I think that, you know, the way that you talked about the vertical game is so dead on, Mark. And I love the way that he's moving around in the pocket. Yeah. He's starting to do a better job, too, of holding on to the ball and keeping his at least keeping both hands on the ball, which is something that he had some difficulty with at Washington State. And he'd lose the ball often. But the ability to overcome mistakes, to stay resilient, the way he reads the field, the way that he leads this team is something that can be extremely helpful, especially for an unconfident team. Because I think the Jaguars are kind of like probably 60 to 70% of the NFL teams. They're confident enough on the outside that if things are going their way, they're going to play really well. But they're also the type of teams that when something bad happens, they go into a shell or go, oh, there we go again. And they start to tense up and overthink and then overreact to things and not play well and make those few mistakes. And I think a guy like Minshew has been playing well and then also leads well enough by example and with other people to be able to get them out of that mindset. And I think you ride that for as long as you can.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's that sort of it factor that, you know, we kind of saw in him down in Mobile, but it's translated into the NFL, and that's going to be huge for this locker room, which Bortles probably didn't have that. And now they have it with this kid.
Yeah. And I think, you know, considering they were probably just happy that they had two to three quarterbacks who could read cover two. So well, I think that was probably good too. So you alluded to him. Thoughts on DJ Chark and his progress?
I'm actually going to take a time out here. I want to use some extra time. And, you know, I'm not a wide receiver guy, or at least I don't know it that well. Like, I know quarterbacks, but I know enough to associate myself with people like the learned Mr. Waldman and guys like Michael Kist and Joe Ferriola, who were both very high on DJ Chark coming out. And so, you know, when I got a chance this season, obviously studying Minshew, I've seen a lot of him getting ready to do this show. I studied him some more. I've been extremely impressed with his body control. You look at his ability to sort of get into and out of routes, to get, you know, his body extended to make catches. He had a catch on a deep out or a comeback route. Wasn't quite sure exactly what he was running based on the way the play developed, but against Denver in the first quarter of that game, where he has to really sort of extend himself, it's a throw that's sort of high and towards the boundary to his left, and he has to go up and get it, but he's able to do it in a way that he just sort of maintains great ball control as he's doing it. So the body control you see there, his touchdown against Tennessee in week three comes in, you know, the first quarter on a 3rd and 11. Great release off the line of scrimmage. He's given a free release against press coverage, but he has the body control to stack the defender on his back as he's getting into the end zone on his vertical route. Sort of uses that off arm subtly. It's not going to get flagged, but to create a little space at the catch point, goes up and gets the football. I was extremely impressed with that catch. But now I'm going to tell you about the greatest 6-yard catch in the history of football. And yes, friends, that surpasses the catch, which was a 6-yard touchdown from Joe Montana to Dwight Clark. And this came on a 2nd and 12 late in the first half against Denver, where he is running just a simple crossing route right to left. Okay. And the throw is behind him. So he has to twist, open up his body to the left, twist back, and make the catch. So the body control to do that at a full sprint across the field, running parallel to your quarterback, that's extremely impressive. And I could stop there and still say this is the best 6-yard catch in the history of the National Football League. But as he does that, he sees that the coverage defender, the nearest defender to him, is about to lay a shot on him. So he's able to keep twisting and turn his pivot back to make the catch into a spin move as he lands on the turf away from the defender to create just a little bit additional yardage after the reception. When I saw that play, Matt, my mind literally exploded. I am speaking to you now as a ghost because I am dead, because that play literally blew my mind.
That's awesome. And you had time to spare, so we don't even get to play the spooky music that goes with it.
Right. But I can play mine. But yeah, look, he's been impressive. That catch, it was a put the pen down moment. It literally, that's what it was.
Yeah, it was. And I think that's the big thing about DJ Chark and why he's performed so well this year is I think the route running was something that you saw evidence of him going to be fine. Like, he could be a sound route runner in the league at LSU. The biggest issue for me was how he caught the football, because you would see him make excellent catches. So you saw the hand-eye coordination. It was very strong, and it would often be in tight coverage, but he didn't know how to use his hands. He didn't know how to really maximize the opportunity to catch the football. You know, guys like Cortland Sutton right now still clapping their hands on the football and making it an adventure. The touchdown that he had in that game, literally the front half of the ball went through his hands and into his face mask before he actually secured the back end of the ball. You know, and so while he had a good game and he's having a good season, I still look at him and think, oh, it's a little bit too adventurous for me, because he's not reliable in terms of how he makes catches. And if he were facing Jalen Ramsey or AJ Bouye on a regular basis instead of, you know, the reserve that they had in there, I would be a little bit more reticent about him. I think that you look at what, you know, Chark has done. He's now corrected his hand position, and so now his game's really blossoming, because you can count on him in just about every situation, and I'm extremely impressed with him.
2 seconds to spare, Mr. Waldman. Another fantastic job there.
All righty. Well, listen, let's hear some of the awesome work that you're going to tell me about. What's wrong with the Rams' offense?
Yeah, it's interesting, because, again, doing my prep for the show, I went back – you know, watch their game against Cleveland again, watch their stuff against Tampa Bay last week. And I just assumed that we were going to see a lot of what we saw in the Super Bowl, right? We know it's a copycat league. We know that Belichick rolls out cover four and really tries to keep stuff in front of the defenders and basically said, look, Jared Goff, read some coverages and make some reads and throws and try to do it on your own. They did the stuff where they would adjust the defensive formation late in the play clock when Sean McVay couldn't then radio in and say, hey, no, they're going to be running cover two now because the mic was cut off, the radio was cut off in Goff's ear. So I expected to see a lot of that. But I think what's happened is that offensive line, which did such a great job last year at making Todd Gurley look great, at making, you know, CJ Anderson come in and look great, at protecting Jared Goff, they've had some struggles. You look at some of the throws and the interceptions, there were just basic, you know, Shaq Barrett situations where guys weren't getting blocked and he was making throws under duress. They did some simulated pressure stuff. Goff did. Wow.
You know what? Let's take a timeout for you.
Take a timeout there too, because I got one more quick thing to mention. Right. They had a great sim pressure look with that creeper stuff that we've seen at LSU and guys like that use in the college game, where they sugared the A gap with one linebacker, but he drops. They drop the safety down into the box late, and he actually blitzes. So from a viewing standpoint of the quarterback, you still think it's that same guy blitzing because you see the blitz coming. Yes. You don't focus on it, but they've dropped that linebacker, and he get himself into the throw and lay it on that slant route. It's a simple slant flat. Goff sees blitz, thinks that it's the linebacker that's coming, doesn't realize the linebacker dropped under the throw, and he throws it right to him for a pick. And so teams are doing some different stuff to confuse them, which is part of it. And the pass protection issues, I think, are a problem as well.
Yeah, I do think that the pass protection issues are probably one of the biggest problems there. And I love that you brought up that blitz exchange that was there. That was something I highlighted on Sunday or Monday morning, I think, when I was watching that game. That and just trying to explain, too, that it was more a good defensive play than it was a bad offensive play. Yeah. I mean, certainly something he needs to be able to read and see late. You know, you would love to see that. But I think the biggest thing, one of the biggest things, too, is this run game. Like, how do they figure out this run game to be better between the tackles as opposed to outside the tackles? And I think that, you know, some of the teams have played that wide six, that tackle wide six, or a Landry 4-3, where you see an emphasis of, you know, being able to run to the outside and stop the outside run. And they're kind of slow to adjust to that. They wait till like the second half in the Cleveland game to adjust. But as my buddy Eric Stoner would talk about, you know, one of the things that he mentioned when we were having a conversation about it is that you'd just love to see them maybe develop some, you know, plays, a handful of plays where they run more trap or different things where they can work inside and maximize the ability that they have of those running backs to work inside and have an inside game that complements the outside game. And I think that's important. It's like, it's kind of a missing link to this offense that spends so much time running to the edge that if you can kind of develop a dangerous inside game, that would be helpful to make them a little less predictable.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. And it's part of the reason they were successful in the playoffs last year is because they had that with Anderson. They had more of the inside stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, all right, where are we at here? All right, how about this? We are back. No, we aren't. Okay, let's name three teams you would like to see AJ Green wind up with after his contract expires, because you know he's sitting there going, I'm waiting until I'm 100% healthy to come back. Because my contract's expiring, and I think that means is I want to showcase my talents to a contender.
Yeah, exactly. Ed, we'll have three teams here. We're going to go with the Homer one right out of the gate, and I'll say the New England Patriots because, come on, I'm greedy, okay? We want seven right. Super Bowl titles, whatever. I'm a selfish man. I think Jacksonville. And Jacksonville is interesting because you pair him with DJ Chark. You pair him with a young quarterback who's a bit more aggressive than Andy Dalton, perhaps. Bit more willing to take some throws downfield, perhaps better touch in the downfield passing game. I think that would give AJ Green a chance to show off some of what he can do. And the third one is from more of a conceptual standpoint, and that's Washington. As long as Jay Gruden is there, or if not Washington with Jay Gruden, then Oakland with Jay Gruden, their new offensive coordinator, because I've been extremely impressed with what Washington is doing from a schematic, conceptual standpoint offensively. They just have had pitiful, poor quarterback execution, but the route designs are there. And I think if you put AJ Green in what Jay Gruden is dialing up, he would have tremendous success. So those would be my three teams: New England, Jacksonville, Washington.
I love those three teams. So I'll get my homer one out of the way and say the Seattle Seahawks with Russell Wilson in the sense that, yeah. Yeah. Because just for the fact that you could exploit his deep game, you can also work him. Imagine working him from the slot, because I think he could play the slot if he needed him to, especially as he gets a little bit older. He's such a good route runner. He could be a fun option, and he'd be someone that could work with, you know, kind of work with DK Metcalf, or at least lead by example. That would be fun. Not that DK Metcalf's ever going to have AJ Green's route running skills, but there are some things that might be helpful in terms of things that he could pick up and learn and get the most out of his game. So I like that. I'm going to go ahead and add the Baltimore Ravens to this list, because as odd as that may sound, to be able to put him outside or inside, you know, I know that Lamar isn't great on some of those outside timing routes, but I think as good of a route runner as Green is, that might be very helpful to him and some of the intermediate routes. And he's good at working over the middle, and you get a tough guy that you can go to late in these games. There's some throws, there's some catches that Miles Boykin didn't really make that could have, you know, a couple weeks ago, and that, you know, that a guy like Brown hasn't quite made. So you can add some versatility to this team, and he's a tough blocker. I'd like to see him stay in the AFC North and haunt some of these other teams. And just for the fun of it, I'd like to see him in Atlanta. And the only reason I'd say that is, like, as good as their receivers are, it would be fun to have him opposite Julio Jones, and have kind of a homecoming in the Georgia area. But I think, to be honest with you, the better answer would be, yeah, there we go. I'd say the better answer would still be New England. I have to agree with you about that, is that I think that that would be a good match. That would be a good match for him and Tom Brady.
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, it's still a homer answer. Yeah. And I'm sure 31 other fan bases are yelling at me right now, and that's fair.
And really, the best answer that we didn't say is New Orleans, because if they have a second receiver in there, second receiver with Drew Brees and the route running that he can run, actually, that's probably the best answer I would.
I mean, it's with AJ Green, it's probably, is there anywhere where it wouldn't work? And that list is probably really small.
Pittsburgh, because he hates the Steelers.
Yeah, that's true. And, and Mason Rudolph is a big question mark right now. I mean, I think that's it. That's the list.
That's about it. All right. So who's a quarterback prospect? Actually, I was wrong about that. I'm skipping through things. All right. So we're going to go back to the haunted house question. Why is it that young quarterbacks have early success and then stall out? I mean, a good example is Marcus Mariota. He had that 4-touchdown debut. And everybody was like, oh, my goodness, he's the second coming. And then he's, you know, he's had kind of an up and down career at this point, even though there's moments that you really love what he does. And, you know, it's kind of, to me, it relates to that question about Daniel Jones, of where, you know, people are celebrating him and he is playing well right now. But, you know, what is that reason why young quarterbacks have early success and then suddenly you look at them and it seems like the exact opposite's going on?
Strangely enough, Mariota had my favorite throw of last week by any quarterback. And I couldn't believe it. It was that touchdown he threw, the touch route on the out pad with anticipation. Yeah, it's weird. I think part of it is, when we see quarterbacks have success early in seasons, a lot of it is due to the fact that defenses are still trying to figure out what they do well. And so there are opportunities for quarterbacks to exploit defenses that are still figuring things out. That might have been a case with Mariota in his debut, probably a case for Jones in his game against Tampa Bay. But I think the other thing is, when they're playing early, it's a chance where the offense has to focus on what that quarterback does well before the defense figures it out. And so there's that narrow window where you can just let them run what they want to run, let them run what they're familiar with, what they like running during training camp, and be successful with it. Eventually, teams are going to say, oh, okay, well, they run mesh, they run smash, they run Mills, they run Yankee. That's it. We can defend these three ways, it will be fine. And then the quarterback now has to adjust. And that's when you see that drop off. So it's just a chance of getting them some early stuff that they like to run before they have to really figure out how to play football in the National Football League.
Yeah. And I think that that's such a great answer, because that also allows for things like being able to only read half the field, or, you know, or you have plays where the play is set up where you have really one read, and you're just, it's a built-in manipulation as opposed to a full field progression read. And so there's some differences there with that. And I think that that's, that's a good answer with it. And then teams also underestimate what a quarterback can and can't do. You know, they look at a guy like Daniel Jones in the same way that they would look at a guy like Cooper Kupp at wide receiver and go, he's not that fast. So, you know, if they run the option, you know, and he works to the outside, linebackers or safeties are going to underestimate his burst to the outside at first. And he's going to work around them for a few plays, and they could be big plays that get them in the red zone or end up in scoring. And oftentimes they want to look at a level of tape before they see that. And those assumptions tend to last for 3 to 4 to 5 weeks, because the way the NFL's set up, they end up, you know, they look at batches of tape at a time, where you end up starting to develop game plans off those scouting reports that are current reports from 4 weeks of tape. That's been the old scouting kind of thing of what they've done. And I think, you know, that's why young quarterbacks often start off strong, because they benefit before the teams actually put that stuff together in terms of the backlog research work.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it.
All right. So let's, you know, let's talk about Danny Torrance here. Is it, you know, we just mentioned it earlier. Did he show improvement with feeling pressure in the pocket last week? I mean, I don't think I've ever seen that before with another young quarterback who I didn't think had that.
Yeah, I think he did. And, you know, I think I was probably a little bit higher on him after his game against Tampa Bay than it sounds like you were. It seems like, you know, you highlighted the fact that, yes, there were times when he missed Shaquille Barrett. You know, he missed some backside pressure. He didn't feel it the way you'd like to see a quarterback do it. But maybe this is just an example of a quarterback that can actually learn. And maybe this is one of those windows into why we sometimes get evaluations wrong, because if we're seeing Daniel Jones learn from 1 week to the next, like, oh, I got to be smarter in how I handle the pocket, I got to feel this backside pressure, because Shaq Barrett had quite the introduction to me, you know, in my first game as a quarterback in the National Football League, then maybe that's one of those situations where we now have documented evidence from 1 week to the next of a quarterback learning and figuring it out on the fly. And so to see that little jump in pocket presence from week one to week two for him, I think was an impressive thing to see. And so, yeah, I think he did get better at it. And it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't something I thought he had in his bag coming out of Duke. But now in two games, we've seen him, I think, handle the pocket well in week one and handle it even better in week two.
Yeah. And I think that, I'm willing to be open to the idea that he will continue to improve. I was surprised that he did what he did. And I hope I'm wrong with it from the standpoint of, you know, rooting for him to do well. You always want players to do well. Now that I've said that, I need to also go back and say, as a husband to a UNC matriculate who is very much, you know, a big part of North Carolina and hates Duke, to the point that when I hypothetically once asked her, if we had another child and they were as athletically gifted as you were and got a scholarship to go to Duke for some sort of big sport, and, you know, and there was a program there that they wanted to study that was, you know, unique to what Duke did and what their staff had, could they go, you know, without us having an issue? And she said, as long as you left the house too. So,
oh, your wife's the best.
So yeah, she's unbelievable. She is definitely a living tall tale. So I would say that I would say that on that note, no, I don't. You know, I'm still skeptical, but I'm open to the idea as long as that there's room in that basement.
There is always room for you here at Casa de Schofield, my friend. So if you need it, I'm here.
I appreciate that. So, funny enough, my best friend when I was growing up, he ended up at Duke. So we actually, what was funny is I'd go to Duke campus occasionally and visit him during that time. My wife was at UNC. That would have been kind of funny if we had met earlier before that. But, all right. So who's a quarterback prospect? Now, speaking of Daniel Jones, and you and I might find ourselves saying that we were dead wrong about him. Who's a quarterback prospect you were dead wrong about that's been established?
You know, I mean, I'm going to go in sort of a different direction and away from Daniel Jones, and I'm going to say Connor Cook. I loved Connor Cook as a prospect, believe it or not. And you look at that Goff, Dak, Wentz class, a lot of people had Paxton Lynch, QB3, and then it was a bit of a question mark after them. Connor Cook was my QB4. And Connor Cook was a player that I loved because I liked his attitude. I liked his moxie. I know a lot of people sort of mocked him, ripped him after the Big Ten championship game. And he sort of like ripped the trophy from somebody's hand and seemed cocky and arrogant. And I heard rumblings that, look, they didn't like him. You know, nobody would go to his birthday party, that kind of thing. But I always thought, look, you need a bit of a chip on your shoulder. You need some arrogance playing the quarterback position. So that coupled with his ability to make throws from the pocket, I thought, look, this is a guy that can work in the National Football League. Come to find out that, look, there are other things you need to be able to do other than, you know, act cocky and make a throw from the pocket on 3rd or 7. There's more to play in the quarterback position than just that. And so I missed badly on Connor Cook.
Yeah, and I liked Connor Cook myself, Connor Cook as well. The guy that I'll just have to say that I was definitely dead wrong about was Blaine Gabbert. You know, and I think most people look at that and laugh about the Blaine Gabbert thing for anybody who liked Blaine Gabbert. But for me, it was a lesson in understanding that when it comes to pocket play, you really want to see where the player is at in their current state and their most current tape. Because pocket play and how you manage the pocket and how you feel about the pocket can change. A guy like Trent Edwards was an absolute stud in the pocket, in horrible pockets. And then after the hit he had against the Cardinals when he was with the Bills, as he was starting to show a little bit of promise, his game changed from that on. And I think, you know, Blaine Gabbert, I saw some early tape of him, like I think as a sophomore, and saw some tape from him that I was really impressed. But then I ignored a lot of the tape that he had as a junior and just felt like I applied circumstances that weren't there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, I get that a lot. I see exactly what you're saying about him right there.
So who's a quarterback prospect, Mark, that the public might think you were wrong about, but you're going to maintain till your dying day that you were right?
I'm going to say Vernon Adams. And part of it is because, look, I literally in my scouting report I said, we know what's going to happen. He's not going to get a shot. He's going to go to the CFL and he'll probably have some success there. And it seems like that is playing out because last I checked, he was at least playing in the CFL. I don't know if he's having the kind of success I imagined for him, but I thought that this kid had some talent. I thought that this kid had the ability, and maybe it's just a situation that, you know, he's a couple of years ahead of his time, because maybe if Vernon Adams comes out now, he gets a different look than the way he got sort of evaluated and treated when he came out. Because there were people, I wasn't alone on this, there were people that really sort of liked him, but the NFL just didn't even give him the time of day. You know, it was one of those situations where they were looking at him as, you know, maybe a defensive back convert. Otherwise, he's probably not going to get looked at. I know he was in a training camp, but that didn't really last too long. And so he was quickly into the CFL. I think if he comes out now, it's a different situation. So, yeah, I was high on him. He was like my QB5 or something, but I still think I was right.
Yeah, yeah. I felt the same way about Vernon Adams. Obviously, I feel that way about Chad Kelly. But I'd say the guy that I really feel that way about more than anyone is Nate Davis out of Ball State. And where I'm wrong about him is that his attitude and his behavior in terms of about the game. And that's important. But those were things that I don't really have the opportunity to scout. I only have the opportunity to scout what's on the field. And from what I've scouted on the field, you know, this is a guy that could move well in the pocket. He was someone that could throw on or off structure. He threw a beautiful football. And he was someone that had a lot of accuracy and a real good feel for the game. But he was also someone that was just a slow learner in terms of maturity overall. And he had a real opportunity to play, with the Colts when Peyton Manning had the neck surgery. And leading up to that, the story I heard was that Bill Polian thought he was a first round talent and brought him in thinking he'd get a tryout to start in place of Peyton Manning and maybe be their franchise option if Manning couldn't return. And that was what they were looking at. And he came into camp overweight. He started throwing bad balls, thought he was like the king, and they got rid of him within about 2 weeks. And now he was playing in the NFL.
Look, we all have misses. It happens. So, but sometimes we're still right in the end.
Yeah. That's it.
Oh. Sorry.
So how about this? That's all right. That's all right. So who's your favorite safety in the league?
This is going to sound like such a homer answer, and I don't care. It's Devin McCourty. It's Devin McCourty because of his flexibility and from a positional standpoint, from a coverage and technique standpoint. You might see him at times line up as a corner, which he was at Rutgers, and be a press man corner against a specific receiver that Bill Belichick is worried about, because obviously Bill Belichick trusts him basically probably more than anybody else on that roster. And I might even include Tom Brady in that mix because of the way the Patriots use this safety. You will see him at times down in the slot. They will use him to cover guys like Travis Kelce. I mean, to take your free safety who's got kind of built like a longer corner and put him one-on-one against Travis Kelce because you're worried about a tight end. That's a huge sign of respect from Bill Belichick, because we know Bill Belichick is terrified about tight ends, especially like Travis Kelce. You see him down in the box at times. You see him in run support. You see him playing deep safety, half field, full, you know, middle of the field, you know, cover one type looks. They let him do so much, and he does it at such a high level. It's Devin McCourty.
Nice. Nice. So I'm, you know, my official answer, I guess, is going to be Eric Weddle. I like how Eric Weddle plays the game. But I want to talk about another guy who's still kind of haunts me to this day, and it's Eric Berry. Just because, even though he's no longer in the league, if I'm right, I think I'm right about that, correct? I mean, he's not playing for anybody. I don't think he's playing for anybody anymore. It kind of faded away after the illness and then the injuries, but just as the type of player he was, the range he had, how hard of a hitter he was, how good he was in run support. He was a smart player. He made timely plays. He anticipated the ball well. I thought he had the capability of having a Hall of Fame career that was unfortunately cut short. He was a fantastic player, and I wish that, you know, I think that the outcome of the Chiefs-Patriots game could have been different if the Chiefs had like a full health, you know, in prime Eric Berry playing in that defensive backfield.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, he was such a great player. And, you know, it's funny when you were asking, you know, is he currently on a roster? I Googled it quickly, and he's still a free agent, but you on the Google search result, you have the news stories at the top. There's like articles from like six different fan websites or six different teams websites saying, oh, an Eric Berry signing could make this defense spectacular. So people obviously right. share your feelings about him.
Yeah, he was a great player in that respect, and I figured that he was gone. But yeah, local product here out of Atlanta, who I always really loved his game. Who's a rookie not starting in the NFL right now at any position who your advice to fans would be to stay patient with for a year or two?
I'm going to go Damian Harris, and part of it is concern about Sony Michel. Part of it is concern about Sony Michel's knee history. Because he's had some injury history as well. Part of it is how we know the Patriots like to use multiple backs in their running back room, running back by committee type of situation. And look, you've got Rex Burkhead and James White, who are obviously, you know, more veteran players. And I think when you go back and watch Damian Harris out of Alabama, the thing that really stood out to me, you know, obviously viewing it through a Patriot set of, you know, colored glasses once they made the draft pick, was how Alabama trusted him on the field on third downs, and they trusted him in pass protection. They trusted him in blitz pickup. And these are all things that are going to be critical to the New England Patriots offense, whether Tom Brady is there or not. And so you put these factors together. I think, you know, if you're a dynasty player and you have the opportunity to acquire Damian Harris, I know he got a lot of buzz early in training camp anyway, but if he's still out there or still available for acquisition, try to do it, because you put these factors together, I think he's going to find himself in this New England offense sooner rather than later.
Okay. Okay, good. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to say Hakeem Butler. I think that people look at that and say, well, he was a guy that I know that, you know, this guy I rated highly. And I know that a lot of people who listen, who are fantasy players, will look at him and go, well, he didn't even make a starting lineup before he got hurt. And, you know, wasn't even the best, one of the better receivers on his team at this point. And they said he had a long way to go. But I look at, you know, what I saw from him in training camp, and I saw some of the routes that he ran. I thought he did a good job with some of those routes. I thought that, you know, the issue for him probably more than anything is working through press and being able to catch the football consistently and not make some of the mistakes that he did. But he would have earned playing time in this offense, I have a feeling. And he would have worked his way into a rotational spot at the very least this year if he didn't get hurt. I think that he still is a fantastic talent. It's just going to take him maybe a little bit longer in terms of the consistency standpoint. But I'm not concerned about that lack of consistency because the technique's there. The technique's there, and I think that he's only going to get better at what he does, and I think he can be a fantastic player in this league. So we are running out of time, but I'd like to do one more question, Mark, and I know that we have probably about three or four that we could have asked. Is there one on that list, if you have that list near you, that you prefer? And if not, I can just choose.
We got time for – let's do – since two of these are related, let's do three more in a sense. You can look at our list, 23, 24, and 25. I do want to hit those so we can fit these in.
Okay, let's do it. Okay. So you're down – the first one is you're down 4 in the Super Bowl against an excellent pass rush and a defense that's playing man-to-man coverage. Who do you want as your quarterback from these choices that I've listed? Drew Bledsoe, Jim McMahon, Rich Gannon, Steve McNair, or Donovan McNabb?
Okay. And at the outset, I think we have to take McNabb and kind of remove him from this because he had this chance against New England and it didn't fare too well.
Okay.
And so I think I'm gonna eliminate him because of that. Okay. For this one, and we got a follow-up to this with the same quarterbacks, just a different sort of set of circumstances. But for this one, an excellent pass rush and a defense that's playing man-to-man, I want Steve McNair. I want a guy that can create, that can extend, that can escape this pass rush. And if he gets an opportunity in a man-to-man coverage situation, he's going to burn you with a well-placed throw. He can burn you with a deep ball. If you're playing man-to-man, you're going to see a lot of situations where the defenders have their back to him and he can create with his legs. So you put all that together, my pick here would be Steve McNair.
Yeah, no surprise. I would pick the same thing, but I'm going to give an honorable mention to Jim McMahon because I thought he was one of the smarter quarterbacks in the league who also could extend plays. He could hang tough in the pocket. He made great anticipatory throws. And he was someone with the kind of attitude that could rally a team around him. And if the team wasn't playing up to its best, he was also someone that would jerk them in line. So I really like that about him. So in the other end of the spectrum, so you're down 4 in Super Bowl, and this time the opponent's defense has great safeties and linebackers, and they play primarily in zone, and they don't get pressure very well, so they often need to blitz in order to get pressure. Who are you picking from that same list?
You know, it's interesting. I think you kind of made a decent argument there to include McMahon perhaps in this one. I think Bledsoe is an intriguing option as well, but I'm going to go with Rich Gannon because I think Gannon was a very smart, heady quarterback. I liked the way he sort of read defenses and read coverage, especially, you know, underneath rotations. I thought he had feel for those plays that I'm not sure the other guys in this list really had. And still, look, if you're going to blitz him, he's still athletic enough to sort of create and extend if he has to. It's not something that it was really his calling card, especially when he was a good quarterback at the end of his career. But I think Gannon would be the guy I'd want in that situation.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with you. That was my pick as well, just because he was someone that could create away from the blitz. He had a really good feel for the pocket, but he also was an intelligent guy who could extend but also play well in rhythm. And I like that option a lot. So I guess our final question is this, and it was ask your co-host any question, football or non-football related, that you've always wondered about with them. So I'm going to lead off, and considering that I ticked you off with the with the question that we had earlier with the Toto band member who I thought looked like Albert, you know, looked like Robert Downey Jr. Did you dance to a Toto song at your wedding?
I did not, believe it or not. Although I will say we did not dance to Toto. Our first dance was Elvis, you know. But one song that we did dance to, and this was actually, and I know my parents are listening because they love, you know, the Quick Game Show. The Standells, Dirty Water, which if you've been to a Boston Red Sox game, when they win, they play that when they win. And so my parents, they brought the CD. So this, you know, Dirty Water by the Standells was something that they did play. But yeah, you know, we did not dance to Toto at our wedding. Surprisingly, I get a lot of Toto questions, but I've never been asked that one, Matt.
See, there you go. All right. Well, cool.
So here's my question for you. And I thought about going in a couple of different directions. Maybe ask you what the last book you read was or something like that. But I thought this was a great chance for Matt to highlight something that I don't think a lot of people know about him. So, Matt, I'm going to ask you this. And your answer could be based on whether it's things that you had to do there or just how it looks or appears or for whatever reason, the aesthetics, the beauty, whatever. What's your favorite city to visit in Skyrim?
Oh, I love that game. That's a good question. Mark and I both love this game. And I played it to the point after RSP season was over. I needed something to kind of, I don't know, decompress a little bit. So when my daughter was off to college, she had left her Xbox there. And I used to just only play Madden occasionally. And that was about it. And she had Skyrim there. And I got hooked on Skyrim. So I think it's not really my favorite city, though. I like the city that's, what's the one north of, oh, I can't remember the name of it. I'm bad with the names, but where all the dark elves live, and it's kind of an ash.
Oh, are you thinking of like the volcano? Markarth?
Yeah. Markarth. I liked Markarth, but I'd say and that's where I usually set up a lot of stuff was on Markarth. But and they had it because the blacksmith there was like a part of the Thieves Guild at one time.
That's so right.
Like, he always had great weapons, and so that was a great place to go. And the house that you end up inheriting if you play through that had a lot of room to set up like a smith, like learn to become a smith and make your own weapons and do all sorts of things there. So that was cool. But my favorite realm was probably when you go into the black books. Cause like, to me, that was like one of the freakiest things in game playing, which is to like open up the book and like your soul disappears into the book. And now you're fighting these monsters that look like.
I remember you made that comparison to me once. These guys are like Jadavian Clowney.
They do. They like move like Jadavian Clowney. They're like, they're big and they've got like, they're extremely agile and powerful. And then like they have the hair that like, if you look at his hair in a certain light, you know, obviously his is much nicer, but you know, the way that the hair texture and the way it comes down from the helmet, it almost kind of looks like that you could see how that if you were going to monsterfy a human being, you could take Jadavian Clowney and he would be like the creatures from this netherworld where, you know, this evil netherworld that you enter through these black books. And they were tough to defeat too. So yeah,
they were. Yeah, I've actually on my desktop, I have all these video game images, like my sort of home screen, my background. And I've got this one shot of Solitude where you're on the outside of the city looking, and that's up on the big arch, like over that little bay. Like Solitude was always my favorite. I outgrew it because, you know, I'm getting older and fatter and stuff. But I bought this mock-up shirt of the London Underground. You know, it's the little logo, and it's got Solitude as the sort of stop, which I loved. I loved that shirt. I had that one, and I had Whiterun too. But I kind of outgrew those. But I did like Riften too, and I actually also have a thing from Etsy of the Bee and Barb. It's like this little flag type thing that somebody like hand painted for the Bee and Barb, which I liked. But yeah, it's such a great game. Every off season, I'm like, I got to pick up Skyrim again. I can't wait for Elder Scrolls 6. It's just cannot wait.
Yeah, I have a feeling that that's probably going to be one I'll be picking up at some point too, because my daughter now has just left the Xbox here and got herself a new gaming system. So the Xbox is in the basement right now.
Just waiting for you.
Just waiting for me. It is. So fortunately I'm not in the basement right now, but, but it's always fun. And I hope you guys enjoyed this as well. Mark and I, you know, really enjoy doing this, and you can follow Mark at Mark Schofield on Twitter. You can check him out not only at the RSP at Pro Football Weekly, at Big Blue Review, Inside the Pylon. He just does fantastic work, and we're so lucky to be able to have him, you know, contribute to the RSP in the way that he does. And you can find the RSP, you know, Matt Waldman RSP Film Room, the RSP cast, you know, on every outlet pretty much that you can consider. And in addition to that, you can find me on Twitter at Matt Waldman, as well as at Football Guys. thank you again. Please provide feedback to this podcast. It's always something that, you know, is valuable for, you know, for us and what we do. And you guys have a good week.